Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I am awesome, David. I am awesome. How are you?
I'm doing great. Before we got a special guest. Before we do the special guest, I want to mention to something for our listeners that's happening tonight. Tonight being the 27th of August, but will be broadcast on YouTube and other various things. Do you want to tell the listeners, Frank, about the event you're doing tonight?
Well, I don't really believe David, but yes, I'm doing a live event tonight at 7 p.m. in the UK, 2 o'clock Eastern in the United States, jointly hosted by Mount Vernon and Monticello on my current book project, which is about the relationship between George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. And I'll be speaking about that and taking questions, and that will last approximately an hour. If you hear this after the event, that's okay, because it will be broadcast. It's going to be broadcast on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter, but it will also be available to view after the fact. Thank you for mentioning it, David.
Yes, well, I want to point out the name of this event that they're advertising is George Washington, Thomas Jefferson. It's complicated, which, you know, bringing this into the 21st century with the relationship statuses and all things is great.
Well, I'm down with the kids, David.
You're down with that's what the students say about you, Frank.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
All right, so Frank, we've got a very special guest. Frank, do you want to make the introductions?
Yes. We're absolutely thrilled today, this morning, to have Bronwyn Everill with us. And Bronwyn is a lecturer at Cambridge. She is the 1973 lecturer in history at Gonville and Caius College at Cambridge. And Bronwyn has just published her second book, for which congratulations, and we're going to spend a few minutes this morning discussing it. It's called Not Made by Slaves, Ethical Capitalism in the Age of Abolition, and it's been published, by Harvard University Press. And David and I have had a chance to read the book, and we wanted to have a chat with Bronwyn because we're very excited and interested by this book. So first off, congratulations, Bronwyn, on a really excellent book. But also, I want to congratulate Harvard University Press, because I actually think it's really nicely produced as a physical book. And so I think you should be very pleased with that as well. But the content of the book is what's really important. So welcome, Bronwyn.
Thank you. Thanks. I know I was it arrived while I was on holiday, and so I came back and opened it and was very impressed by the quality. Yeah.
How does it feel to have it in your hands?
Great. I actually just opened it for the first time last night because I couldn't bring myself to find, you know, all the mistakes and the people that I forgot to mention in the acknowledgments and all that stuff. But it looked better than I thought. Yeah.
It looks great. I mean, that is the worst feeling. I dread looking at things once they're in print because you always find a mistake.
Oh, I've never, ever looked at anything I've ever written after I've published it. Just as a rule, I think that's playing with fire.
I wanted to crack it open in case there was some glaringly obvious thing on page one that you guys were like, so.
So Bronwyn, it's your second book. Your first book was Abolition and Empire in Sierra Leone and Liberia, which came out a few years ago. And now this one. And before we started recording, we were talking a little bit about your academic background and your background as a researcher and your interests. Could you say a little bit to our listeners about that? Because I think it's an interesting trajectory in terms of the content of the new book.
Yeah. So as I was saying, like, I did undergrad in the U.S. I'm American, but and I did somehow manage to take almost exclusively American history classes while I was an undergrad. And I was really only interested in American history. And did my dissertation on abolitionists, John Brown, and sort of violent abolitionism. And then I was sort of flirting with the idea of archaeology. And so I came over to England in 2005 to do my master's in archaeology. And in that, I ended up focusing on sort of the archaeology of settler colonialism and empires, so not just material culture, but also like landscape and the built environment and that kind of thing. And then I worked in a museum for a little bit. And while I was doing that, I was trying to figure out a way of bringing my interest in abolitionism and American political history to like my new interest in settler colonialism and archaeology. And so my first book which was came out of my PhD dissertation, which I did at King's College London, was looking at sort of the development of settler cultures in Sierra Leone and Liberia, which were anti-slavery colonies set up by the British and American and abolition movements, and sort of thinking about how those ideas of imperial settlement and sort of ideas of colonialism interacted with the abolition movements and sort of universal ideas of liberalism and freedom and that kind of thing.
Go ahead.
So that was my first book. And that was, you know, it was very much on the sort of political side. And actually, in the end, I didn't end up doing very much about with the sort of archaeological background, which actually I think comes in a bit more in this newer book. I think that sort of, it sort of fell away when I was doing my PhD, but then it popped back in this, in researching for this book.
Well, I think the new book is really interesting because it's on a number of levels, but the methodology, which I hope we'll talk about in a couple of minutes, is one of the things that really interested me because it really is interdisciplinary in a lot of ways. Would you consider yourself a West African specialist now? West Africa is obviously the main theme of your first book, but you mentioned that in Not Made by Slaves, one of your goals is to kind of center West African in the story of Atlantic abolitionism.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think I have one of these weird positions where I never had to say what I do.
Right.
So I'm just a lecturer in history, generally. And I teach African history, and I teach American history, and I dabble a little bit in teaching economic history. But so I think I've sort of always been able to avoid labeling myself. I have a specialism in West African history. But I think what I hoped with this book that I was trying to do was sort of link up the Atlantic world into the 19th century in a way that obviously is tied up with the sort of spread of imperialism, because you can't really avoid that, but also keeps U.S. history in the story. I think, you know, people have done a really amazing and thorough job of reintegrating all the sort of component parts of the Atlantic in the period up until the beginning of the 19th century. But I think that, and I found this when I was writing the book as well, like keeping that story going is really hard once the U.S. is out of the British Empire, once the sort of Iberian empires start to collapse and they're, you know, their own functioning republics or whatever. So, you know, once the political dimension falls away, I think it's still really important to keep the economic unit of the Atlantic world, you know, in the picture, but it's harder to do with the sources, and it's harder to do, you know, focusing just on culture and economics and that kind of thing.
Yes, I think you're right about that. I mean, David and I have talked about this in the past. The Atlantic paradigm works really well for the 18th century when you've got these large empires that encompass lots of different polities and spaces. It doesn't work so well for once we have a world or an Atlantic region of different nation states.
Exactly. But to tell the story that I wanted to tell, and I think, you know, more broadly, to tell a story about the spread of global capitalism, you do need to find a way of keeping these things linked up. And you know, retreating to the nation state is easy because that's where and I don't mean to, you know, cast aspersions on people who do it. There is a story to tell there, and there's a cohesive political unit in which to tell the story. But I think actually what I was trying to say with this book is there are continued parallels, and more important than the parallels, there are these like prolonged connections into the 19th century.
Yeah, that was one of the things I found most impressive about this book is the way you actually, you know, people have been talking about writing Atlantic history for decades now, and I guess we should mention the passing, or I guess last week, of Bernard Bailyn, who sort of helped establish this sort of field, but very rarely people write it in such a way where the story feels equally at home in West Africa, in London, and in Philadelphia in the way that you do in this book. And so I just wanted to applaud you. I thought that was a really, it was really impressed. I was very impressed by the ways in which it actually does the, what Atlantic history sort of sets out to do in a real way.
Thanks. I think, I mean, you know, you were saying you wanted to talk about the methodology. I think that might maybe derive from the fact that, like, I feel at home and not at home in all of those places as well. You know, I think probably writing American, I mean, as you guys know, writing American history from the other side of the world, you know, can help, I think, in sort of shifting the focus to, or seeing it as equally important to all these other places.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, and it's interesting. So, you know, in many respects, Bernard Bailyn's successor as the big proponent of Atlantic history at Harvard is David Armitage. And he, of course, David is British, but lives in the United States. And so there, a lot of people who are engaged in this enterprise do seem, as you know, Bronwyn, to be like ourselves, sort of transnational academics. And we're perhaps more comfortable in that world than sometimes our subjects themselves are. One reason why I think this is important is because the although we struggle as historians to write Atlantic history post, say, 1815, it's no less important. One only needs to look at the very active debates about the history of capitalism, and I think you're contributing to that with this book, or the history of slavery and anti-slavery, to see that there are these big transnational entities that still shape the Atlantic world, and we kind of need to get our heads or try to get our heads around them in a world of nation states, notwithstanding the fact that many of those post-imperial nation states are themselves imperial. And so, you know, the 19th century is a very messy century.
Yeah.
I would agree on that point.
It's complicated, yeah.
Yes, it's complicated.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think, you know, as you were alluding to, there is this sort of ongoing discussion about, you know, the relationship of slavery to capitalism, the relationship of nation states to abolitionism. And I think actually, yeah, pushing the story beyond the boundaries of the nation state into the 19th century is really important because it shows that, you know, for instance, yes, Britain abolished the slave trade in 1807, but it was not the first place to do it. And it has this messy ongoing relationship with that. You know, and then to think about how Britain benefits from the slave trade in the sort of creation of its industrial wealth, at the same time that, you know, there's an ongoing slave trade out of West Africa, why doesn't it contribute to, you know, the creation of industrial wealth in West Africa? You know, why does it work the way that it does in the places that it does, towards the contribution to, like, what I'm talking about in the book, like the development of certain kinds of ideas about what capitalism is and what consumer, you know, what consumers can do in a political environment, all that kind of thing, has these sort of like localized, you know, localized tendencies. So, you know, if somebody is having, you know, a trading relationship with West Africa, in Senegal, that's going to have a different sort of impact than a trading relationship in, say, down the coast in the Bights of Benin and Biafra, in terms of how they're, you know, developing their ideas, you know, currency, about fraud and about labeling and all the things that are needed to trade in that particular environment. And that has this knock-on effect on morality, and it has this knock-on effect on, like, you know, ideas about when you can abolish the slave trade and that kind of thing. And so I think that feeds into this idea that, like, you can't do any of this talking about the development of slavery and capitalism, you can't talk about the development of abolitionism without thinking about how these people are interacting on the ground in places around the Atlantic world.
And one of those places, in fact, a core place for this whole story, as you show, is West Africa. And one of your goals is to center West Africa in the story.
Yeah, I mean, it's so the first chapter basically argues that we have to look, well, if you look at what's happening in West Africa in the late 18th century, early 19th century, then it sort of disrupts our idea of where these impetus for abolition is actually coming from. Or it gives us another potential avenue for understanding why abolitionism catches on when it does. So because there are these sort of movements against the transatlantic slave trade in this period in a certain couple of places in West Africa at the same time and using very similar tactics to what's happening in America and in Britain, I argue that, you know, that maybe we should sort of decenter the idea that this is like an Enlightenment project or, or, you know, a particularly Christian project, and think more about the way that these places were all connected by a consumer revolution, and that this is a sort of moment of pushback against a perception of over commodification and over, I mean, I don't use the term globalization, but, you know, that kind of response to those global forces of commercialization in that period.
Right. So let's back up for our listeners. Can you just briefly tell them before we get into more detail what the book's about? What's the kind of pitch for the book?
Yeah. Sure.
What is ethical capitalism in the age of abolition?
Yeah. So, I mean, basically, it's looking at all of the sort of movements and commercial decisions and what I call middle brow economic writings surrounding this idea that consumers are at the heart of political action against the slave trade and then later against enslaved labor. So the free produce movement, the sort of sugar boycotts in the 1790s, those kinds of activities that, you know, people like Lawrence Lippman have written about in books like Buying Power, it takes those as a sort of a connected and sort of like a sort of loosely connected set of ideas about what role the consumer has in the economy, and then looks at how practical business decisions in moving away from the slave trade and in trying to implement, you know, free produce as an actual, you know, thing that people can do, you know, that they can buy free produce. They have to like set up stores, they have to produce labels, all of those things. It looks at how those create a sort of idea of moral capitalism, ethical capitalism in the long 19th century. So it's an accumulation of sort of practical business decisions, but also, you know, writing in abolitionist newspapers, you know, petitions and lobbying of like Congress and Parliament, all of that kind of stuff that sort of forms this growing idea of what ethical capitalism should be in an economy where the sort of the main ethic, quote unquote, ethical arguments are around abolitionism in a sort of international context.
So they're opposing slavery within this kind of capitalist framework by their purchasing, by their, well, on one part of it, because you draw a distinction between free produce and what's the other part of the binary?
Abstentionism, yeah.
Yes, yeah. And legitimate commerce. So it's free produce and legitimate commerce. Mm-hmm. But they're doing this to oppose slavery and trying to kind of create an ethical space within this emerging capitalist system. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, I mean, I think it basically, you know, so because there is this consumer revolution, because everybody, you know, is connected in this way, what I see is that they're trying to use this idea of, or they're trying to like harness the idea of self-interest, right? And this, that people will do what's in their interest. So producers are only using enslaved labor because it's in their interest, because the consumers want the sugar that is being produced, or the cotton that's being produced. and it's the cheapest, and you know, and so it's the consumer's responsibility to demand better of producers, because then producers will shift to using not enslaved labor, because it will be in their interest to do that. And this becomes a sort of, I mean, there's a sort of snowball effect to that, because they're always appealing to self-interest. They're always trying to sort of wrap it in these terms of, you know, supply and demand. That's how the economy works. This is not necessarily an argument against the emergence of capitalism. It's an argument to work within the sort of the system. Profit, you know, they don't have a problem with people making money off of this. In fact, they think people should make money off of this, because that's going to incentivize them to buy, you know, to look for producers who are producing using not enslaved labor and that kind of thing. So, yeah, so there's this sort of idea to harness self-interest and to use the sort of blindness of capitalism to promote these sort of positive externalities, these sort of like good results from for labor and for, you know, the morality of capitalism as a whole.
Oh, I was really interested in this whole sort of section about, you know, these stores that open up in Philadelphia and other places in London about buying ethically, and just how much higher the prices were than the, you know, some there, and all the stuff you have about fraud and people trying to pass off, slave produced products for free products because there was so much more profit. And what it reminded me of, is all the stuff people buy now with that sort of says it's, you know, fair trade coffee and organic stuff, thinking that they're making a meaningful change for workers as a consequence. And I have to admit, I'm guilty of this as well. The section you have on people buying free coffee, so it reminds me of the coffee I get delivered to my house every week that's supposedly grown in an ethical way for farmers. Does that actually make a difference, or am I mostly just buying stuff to appease my own guilt?
I mean, I think the sort of takeaway of the book is that, like, it probably helps at the margins, right? But it doesn't actually, like, change the global relationship. So, yeah, in the second half of the book, I get more into, like, what these arguments actually then mean in terms of global consequences, and part of the problem of harnessing self-interest is that ultimately, yeah, like, fine, you're gonna make a slight dent if there's a middle class consumer who's like, yes, I will spend, I don't know, 38 cents on a bag of coffee instead of 7 cents on a bag of coffee or whatever, but in order to make an actual change in the morality of capitalism, you have to have it be a widespread movement, right? You have to have everybody be willing to shift to ethical producers. And that means it needs to be cheaper than 38 cents because, you know, although there is a sort of stable-ish middle-class market for these kinds of things, no, people can't afford that. Why should they afford that? And in fact, you know, their wages aren't going up. They're not going to be, you know, jumping ship to find more expensive ways of spending their diminishing money. So I think they then decide, I mean, there's no concerted decision, but there's a sort of series of decisions made by, you know, by people over the course of the 19th century and by businesses looking for, you know, free laborers to do this kind of thing, that eventually that kind of work gets farmed out to, you know, colonies essentially, or to people at the margins of the economy. And I don't think that, you know, and so that's sort of the system that we're left with, right? Where, it all works because, you know, okay, we're paying, you know, oh, this sounds really disparaging of fair trade. I'm not against fair trade, but with it, you know, it does only a limited thing, right? Mm. So it's saying basically, like, you know, you have X amount of money. This person abroad has, you know, X minus 100 amount of money. You giving them, you know, a little bit more is going to improve their living conditions a little bit more. It's not going to change the relationship between you and that person. It's not going to change their position as a producer and your position as a consumer of a global good. You know, it's not going to dramatically upend anything about buying power or about the labor market internationally or any of those things. It will just, like, marginally improve their quality of life. And that's the sort of, that's where they end up. That's where these arguments all end up, is sort of, well, as long as you're improving somebody's life marginally, then it's all okay. As long as they're not enslaved.
But it's not going to overthrow the system.
No, they're not interested in overthrowing the system.
I mean, because the book looks at both production and consumption, and it seems to me that what you're suggesting in your response to David Bronwyn is this kind of this free produce movement makes consumers feel better.
Yeah.
But in answer to David's question about fair, you know, buying fair trade coffee, it might make David feel better, but it's not really changing the system of coffee production globally. And the same would have been true for our predecessors as consumers nearly two centuries ago.
Yeah, essentially. I mean, I guess it does change some things a little bit, but it doesn't really, it makes the system marginally more ethical. It does not create an ethical system.
Right. Okay. No, that makes sense. Let me speak up for your consumers, though, and say, well, hold on. You know, you show how slavery, first the slave trade, and then enslaved labor, is gradually abolished across the long 19th century. And you rightly point out that it's a slow, messy process. It doesn't end in 1807. It doesn't end in the 1830s or 1860s. It's a prolonged death, but it does end. And so we've got two massive global systems here that are intimately related, the system of enslaved labor and capitalism, and capitalism is growing in influence during the 19th century. But it does lead to this, in part, this massive systemic change, that is the abolition of enslaved labor. And the folks you write about help to make that happen. I mean, it's a big, complicated story, as I know you both know better than I do, but – it's not nothing.
No. And in fact, I think if I had to stake a claim to novelty in this book, although I don't think I do, I think one thing that I'm doing slightly differently than the people who've written about the topic of free produce before is I'm saying actually it does make a difference. Most people point to the free produce movement and say, look at this. It's like a thing that happened and it's it's important in its time. Unfortunately, it sort of fizzles out and doesn't have much of an impact. And actually, I don't see it that way. I think that free produce, because it harnesses itself to all of these other projects, like, like colonization, what I argue is that, you know, a lot of the people who are involved in free produce stores also have these tendencies towards, free labor. Free laborism, which then becomes the sort of dominant idea of the 1850s and 60s or whatever. And so I am saying free produce does not stand on its own. It's part of this much wider discussion about consumption and production. And unfortunately, I think the way that it makes its biggest political contribution in the U.S. anyway, is by harnessing itself to sort of white free soilerism, ultimately, because it has this inherent contradiction about, like, who it is who's producing and who it is who's consuming. There's ultimately a sort of a discomfort with the idea that, you know, you're buying internationally produced lower priced free labor goods when you could be supporting, you know, in in parentheses, white American farmers at home, you know, producing the same kinds of things on the territory that you're about to take over. And so it sort of ends up, you know, harnessing itself to this other much more influential argument. But I would say that it does have a sort of contribution to that argument as well.
Interesting. Could you comment a little bit about your methodology? I realized I promised we'd bring this up about half an hour ago, but you know, how did you set out to write this book? What were your big challenges? What was your methodology?
I was interested in looking at, like the very first time I thought about this topic was when I encountered Zachary Macaulay's business, Macaulay and Babington, when I was writing my first book. And I was like, oh, I have to come back to this because this is just, this guy is fascinating. This business is so like, it's so all over the place. He, you know, he runs this business on the ground in Sierra Leone from London when he's in London. Although he has this long history of working in Sierra Leone before that. But he bumps into American merchants there. He has all these sort of influential, you know, friends in London, and he adopts a lot of the sort of current trends that are going on in London and tries to export them to the colony and vice versa. And so I was just fascinated by him. And so I initially got into this project, like looking at the businesses themselves and what the businesses were doing on the ground. And I sort of thought about it as a like, oh, I'll just, you know, follow a good from sort of start to end and see how it goes across the Atlantic or whatever. And then I kept bumping into sort of the same American companies as well. So Brown and Ives, who are a firm based in Rhode Island, they kept entering the picture, and then they had all these extensive relationships with Sierra Leone from basically around 1800 through to 1820s. And increasingly, you know, the picture expands and expands. I wanted to keep it centered on the trade that was happening in West Africa in order to sort of think about, you know, how these daily interactions or how the like practicality of running these businesses was influencing things. But as you say, it was methodologically complicated to do that. I had to like think about how African societies, you know, how the Temne are thinking about consumption, how the sort of jihads that are happening in Senegambia and the time are, you know, engaging with these ideas of the slave trade and stuff. And so then I ended up relying a lot on a different kind of source for that, which is like the kinds of poems and polemics produced by those revolutions. A lot of archaeological evidence about consumption patterns and about like migration and how people were, you know, moving from one settlement to sort of escape the predations of slave traders, to establish their own sort of free communities, things like that. So it was a real mixed bag in terms of what ended up being important, what I thought was going to be sort of like a business history of these movements ended up being sort of a wider sort of cultural look at the kinds of ethics of trading practices in West Africa itself.
That was one of the parts that I think I probably learned the most about, because we do all teach about this, or the triangle trade and the ways in which that shaped the Atlantic slave trade. And the way you describe West African as very sophisticated consumers and very sophisticated, you know, in terms of their economic relationships, in terms of the ways in which the consumer goods imported from Europe change over time, which demand changes over time in very complicated ways, I thought was really sort of eye-opening. So I wonder if you could just tell us more about how, you know, who West Africans who are trading slaves for European goods think about themselves as consumers, you know, during the, you know, 18th, 19th, early 19th century.
Yeah, I mean, I think what really, as somebody who approached this topic from understanding abolitionism, I think I had just encountered the ways that abolitionists write about West Africa for so long. And actually, you know, that's one of the things that really, I think, pervades economic thinking to the present, I would even say. Like, this idea that, you know, the slave trade created this state of war in West Africa, and that it, you know, that people were just trading away their, I mean, all of this is in quotes, their countrymen for mere baubles. You know, all of these ideas about, like, the Gigal myth and the gun slave cycle, and this idea that, you know, just any trade between Europeans and Africans was by default and from the very beginning a trade that was detrimental to Africans. And so, you know, obviously people, there is a historiography about, you know, that not being the case. And because I wasn't really a person who had worked on the slave trade before, I had mostly only worked on abolitionists, this was all sort of new to me as well when I started. So all, you know, the idea that actually there's quite a sophisticated, by the late 18th century, there's quite a sophisticated, you know, set of rules in place and the institutions that have been formulated, and, you know, that all of these trading partnerships, you know, go back decades and have their own kind of internal ethics, was a real eye-opener in contrast to what the abolitionists are writing about it, even at the same time, you know, because most of these abolitionists have not been on the ground in West Africa and are just writing off the top of their heads about sort of things that they assume must be the case because of economic theories that they've been reading. And in fact, you know, as the 19th century goes on, many of the sort of disruptions that they are writing about at the end of the 18th century as being caused by the slave trade, are things that are emerging in West African commerce as a result of the disruptions to things like the slave trade. So not that the slave trade is good, and I'm in no way suggesting that the slave trade is good, but I think it's interesting to recognize that abolitionism disrupted an existing form of trade, right? So, like, if for instance, you look at, like, a sort of parallel example, like the war on drugs, right? So, like, obviously, like, the sort of rise of drug cartels in like Colombia or whatever is, like, not good for the local economy, and it's not necessarily good, but it does create a sort of kind of stable political economic structure that then something like the war on drugs, which is supposedly doing something ethically good, has this disruptive effect that then, like, completely, you know, pitches a country into chaos as a result. So a very similar kind of thing happens, right? So that you, and chaos might be a little bit dramatic in this case because it's a prolonged process, but it's certainly disruptive. And so what I was interested in looking at is, like, then how are traders, like, trying to renegotiate and form, like, new rules of trade in the wake of the abolition of legal slave trading? Obviously, like, also, at the same time, there's just tons of illegal slave trading happening, and then there's tons of, like, quasi-legal slave trading happening as well. So so that's, like, a whole other issue. But the traders themselves have to, like, you know, think about things like credit, for instance, which they're, like, really against. The abolitionist traders are really against credit because they're like, oh, it creates these debt relationships, and debt prisoners then get traded into the slave trade, and so, like, debt just is bad. Except that it turns out that they can't just, like, magically conjure some new thing to be traded for the consumer goods that people are looking for, right? So, like, you know, these are not baubles. They're not just, like, mere, you know, accessories to life. By the end of the 18th century, like, you know, people are wearing these cotton cloths. They are smoking tobacco. You know, tobacco is a, like, addictive substance. They want their tobacco. And so how are they going to give it to them? And how are they going to, like, not completely disrupt this trading relationship if they don't have slaves to accept in exchange? And so they have to rely on credit. And so then they have to sort of rethink how they believe credit relationships, you know, can work in West Africa in a way that's not like tied up with enslavement and debt pawning and that kind of thing.
Bronwyn, I was interested that, you know, in the book, one of the things you deal with is the kind of the intellectual history of capitalism in this period, and and you talk about your middlebrow thinkers. Well, religion's a big part of this because you mention ethics, and you know, you talk about ethical capitalism in the title. And I was really interested in the role of religion in the thinking of many of your actors. And you know, we're familiar perhaps with the some of the religious impulses of people, abolitionists in both the United States and Britain. But one of the things I thought was really interesting was the way you brought in Islam in West Africa. So I wonder if you could just comment on the role of religion in this story you're telling.
Yeah, I mean, so the free produce movement is like massively populated by Quakers. I mean, it's got its heart in Philadelphia, and many of the stores are operated by Quakers. And obviously Quakers have a long relationship with abolitionism more generally, but also with like, you know, that kind of capitalism, shopkeeper capitalism or whatever as well. So I, you know, it's a natural sort of marriage, I think, of in that regard. And then, and, you know, the evangelicals, Zachary Macaulay is like, has this great awakening and shifts from working on a plantation in Jamaica to being sort of at the heart of the Clapham sect of abolitionists in Britain. So it's absolutely crucial, you know, for his approach to these kinds of things as well. And so what's intriguing to me is then the sort of third part of that story, which is like the, you know, religious movements that are happening in West Africa. And again, this ties back into sort of the backlash to perceived over-commodification in the, at the end of the 18th century, right? So The leaders who are leading these reformist jihads in places like Senegambia or further down the coast, just north of Freetown, in modern Guinea, they, you know, are rejecting a lot of the things that come along with the sort of consumer capitalism of the 18th century. So they're boycotting rum, for instance, which shouldn't be surprising. You know, it's what is more surprising, I guess, is that there are these sort of moderate military Islamic states that are participating in the slave trade that are buying rum. But yeah, so they're rejecting alcohol sales. They're like sort of trying to turn inwards a little bit in terms of the trade. And in a couple of different cases, they explicitly say that, you know, obviously trading Muslims into this transatlantic slave trade is actually not allowed in Islam. We can't do that anymore. And so the sort of Islamic State of Futuro bans the slave trade with the French, for instance. And so I think, you know, it's interesting to think about how that idea of the Atlantic slave trade is as a sort of like an objectionable practice is actually just as present in the sort of revolutions in West Africa in the late 18th century as it is in the sort of revolutions in France and in America. But equally that it comes from this this position that like actually these states that had been prolific slave traders or had been growing in the slave trade in the case of Senegambia, were you know not adhering to the moral values of the you know the purported moral values of the Islamic leaders who were in charge of them, and so it's sort of part of a general overthrow of that kind of you know ancien regime kind of idea, and then that persists. So you know you get people in the early 20th century who are setting up, you know, so I talk about Nana Asmau, who's the daughter of the leader of the Sokoto Jihad. And she has all these sort of ideas about how you can and can't trade or conduct business ethically that she writes about in her poems. that are, you know, broadly aimed at this community that's part of their expanding empire in what is sort of like now northern Nigeria. And they equally are sort of rejecting the idea of slave trading into the Atlantic. I will like put a massive asterisk there though and say that like the US, there's no attempt to cut down on domestic slave trading, and there's no attempt to end the institution of slavery in these sort of religious in these new religious states. So it's mostly about, you know, trading into the Atlantic. And that's why I think it's tied up with this idea of the like overconsumption of commodities in the end of the 18th
century. What do you think, by way of wrapping up, I felt when I was reading your book, Brahman, there are a lot of contemporary resonances here. Their world looks a lot like our world, was my conclusion. But would you agree with that? What do you think? Would you go that far? Are there contemporary resonances in the story you're telling?
For sure. Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah. I mean, on a lot of different levels, right? Like in that there's a lot of sort of virtue signaling and like brand name recognition and a lot of concern about like policing the boundaries of middle class consumption and all that kind of stuff, which I think is very, very, you know, present in our current moment. So, you know, at that level, but also sort of at the most macro level, I think this is a system that we're still in, right? So, so thinking about these, the global division of labor and like who gets the benefit from capitalism and how are producers and consumers incentivizing each other and responding to each other? That's all part of it. But I think the sort of most striking thing to me at the present moment is this relationship between like consumer power and political power. And I'm actually quite surprised by how resonant that is, because I would think that at the current contemporary moment, that, you know, we know that corporations have a huge, you know, have huge power in politics and that kind of thing. And so seeing people resist corporations or punish corporations or reward other corporations, for their political stances shouldn't be that surprising now. I guess it does surprise me that's actually kind of what I saw happening at the end of the 18th and beginning of the 19th centuries as well. And this sort of idea that people feel the need for their purchasing to reflect their own political values really comes across then, and I think is absolutely a contemporary phenomenon as well.
Did you find yourself consuming in a different way or thinking about your own consumption a different way while you're writing the book?
Yeah, my kids started pointing out every time they saw a fair trade logo. Which, oh, mommy, it's what you're writing about. And I'd be like, well, yeah, kind of. It just made me sigh, you know, because like you want to do things like that. But I also did find that, you know, I haven't like given up buying ethically, you know, on anything, and I probably, you know, don't do more of it than I did before. But what I have noticed about myself doing it is that I, and probably many others, like I justify unnecessary expenses. Like I justify buying a particular kind of face mask for going to the shops because proceeds from it will support, you know, this kind of business or that kind of business. I quote unquote need to buy this other book. I'm going to make sure that I buy it from a black owned business or whatever. But what I find is that like probably a lot of the middle class consumers in the 19th century, I'm mostly doing that on like, you know, to justify unnecessary purchasing.
to be sure. Yeah. And to feel good about ourselves as much as, at least that's how I feel when I drink the coffee with the fair trade logo. I, you know, like to think I'm helping some poor coffee farmer, but in reality, it's mostly for my own sort of middle class satisfaction or something.
Yeah, but I mean, it's better than not, I guess. I don't know.
if those are the options, yes.
Yeah.
Well, on that cheery note.
Well, wait, I have a cheery note. Okay.
Yeah, please.
The pressure on producers, the pressure on, like, you know, the middlemen, so like Sainsbury's and Tesco here in Britain, to stock fair trade bananas, actually ultimately had the effect that they only sell fair trade bananas now, which is the kind of consistent argument that you have. I mean, like, it is only going to make a difference if it is the only way, right? If fair trade is the only trade, then it will make a bit of a difference. You know, if it's just some, you know, you have the option to buy a fair trade banana or a regular banana, then it really never will. But if it eventually pressures those middlemen shops to only stock the sort of quote unquote ethical version, then it will have eventually a small impact. So, you know.
Okay. We'll fight the good fight at the grocery store then.
Right. Well, this has been a great conversation, Bronwyn. Congratulations on your book. It's a really, really excellent book. I learned a lot from it, and I hope others will as well. And we really appreciate your time this morning.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Great. Until next week, Frank. Cheers.
Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is Professor of American History and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.